are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, August 17th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, it's Casual Friday, folks. What a week. On the program today, Cliff Schechter will be joining us to look back on the week in review. Also on the program, special guest from the one of our regular callers. We'll be talking about an issue that he is, or a colleague of his, is dealing with. Also on the program, new Kavanaugh documents show he lied to the Senate. As Democrats vow to sue for more docs. Elizabeth Warren releases a corporate accountability legislation, and Omarosa reveals the Trumps have a campaign hush slush fund. Meanwhile, the bin Laden assassin wants his security clearance pulled too. And Trump wants less disclosure for publicly traded corporations. And in the Senate, Ajit Pai'd in a Senate hearing.
Friday.
Georgia plans to close 75% of voting locations in a, I know this is going to be a shock, predominantly black county. Work requirements coming to Medicaid in Arizona, Maine, and Wisconsin. And lastly, Donald Trump's military parade postponed for reasons unknown. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, casual Friday. I am wearing a soft-collared shirt. I have returned back to the mean, as it were. I did not have a clean T-shirt. And so soft-collared shirt for me today. Of course, I am wearing Zumbas or whatever they call them. Just in my stretchy pants. So that I feel fully relaxed today. And Cliff will be joining us. Stop making comments off mic, Michael. It's so
irritating. Those are really fun because they're specifically designed to irritate you. They're not for the audience.
Well, I can't even hear them half the time. It just sounds all mumbling.
Well, that was literally a Pusha T style yuck.
There you go. Speaking of Pusha T style yuck, we got a email from Elisheva. My husband is a member, Arcady, and he is a huge fan. His 38th birthday is coming up on August 19th. That, of course, is in 2 days, ladies and gentlemen. I was wondering if you give him a shout-out or something. He loves your show and talks about it all the time. He would love a birthday greeting from you guys. That is from Ellie. Ellie, let us just say happy birthday to Arcady. There you go.
Wow, Akbar.
There you go. Birthday is on Sunday, so make sure you enjoy yourself. Folks, reminder, this program relies on your support for its very existence. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com for less than 50 cents a day. I can't do the specific math, but I am very confident it's less than 50 cents a day, maybe less than 45 cents a day. Could even be less than 42 cents a day. I just don't. you have to get into months. I mean, and I'm talking, and I should also tell you, I'm talking about business days. If it was 7 days a week, I can't even, less than 30 cents a day. So it's less than 30 cents a day. I don't know. Maybe it's 32% a day. I can't tell. But the point is, join the majority report, .com. Join the majority report.com. Okay. Yesterday, sadly, Aretha Franklin passed. I believe it was yesterday. Here is how the president of the United States commemorated her life, her life's work, and her passing. She, incredibly important figure in American music for 50 some odd years. The president had some heartfelt words for her.
Well, I want to begin today by expressing my condolences to the family of a person I knew well. She worked for me on numerous occasions. She was terrific. Aretha Franklin, on her passing. She's brought joy to millions of lives, and her extraordinary legacy will thrive and inspire many generations to come. She was given a great gift from God, her voice, and she used it well. People loved Aretha. She's a special woman, so I just want to pass on my warmest best wishes and sympathies to her.
Yeah, there you go. The only part he could actually, the only part that he could ad-lib there was, she worked for me.
It's always fun when he goes from the ad-lib into the written part. Like, yeah. He's like getting into the lane.
Exactly. She worked for me.
She was a dog, and she was a great American.
And a great American. Yeah. And of course, Fox News also commemorated Aretha Franklin's passing. Here is Fox News's report. And, well, here.
She sang with a smile on her face when she performed, and that was what she emitted for so many millions and for so many years. Aretha Franklin, age 76.
That powerhouse voice, an incredibly gifted musician, an amazing pianist.
Yeah. And, of course, they accompanied that rest in peace with a graphic picture of Patti LaBelle as, both African-American women, so that's the way that you commemorate someone's life.
And singers.
Patti LaBelle worked for me, too. Patti LaBelle and Aretha Franklin.
It's hard to tell singers apart because it's just audio.
They both sing.
I don't even understand how you do that. Like, I don't even know how you do that. Like, even if you're, like, an intern, you search Aretha Franklin and you end up with a picture of Patti LaBelle.
We're all just shaking our heads in silence right now.
I feel like if we did something like that, I would end up spending like 45 minutes apologizing for it.
This is not, on screen, obviously, but I'm looking this up. If you just put in a Google image search of Aretha Franklin,
you get pictures of Aretha Franklin.
You will tend to get almost entirely.
I mean, it almost makes you wonder if they don't do it on purpose.
Yes.
Let's just see if this someone's having a laugh, or if they think this is going to help our search engine optimization.
Let me Fox News it. I put in black lady singers, and you know what? Patti LaBelle still isn't even up there. Aretha is. Aretha is still in the top search results for black lady singers, and they didn't confuse her with Tina Turner or Lauryn Hill. or Brandy. Wow, that's an amazing search result for Brandy.
All right, let's talk about. I'm gonna be talking about this a little bit with Cliff. Today is like one of those days where there are stories that I think are silly, but they're important because, for better or for worse, I would probably argue for worse. In the final analysis, our society gravitates towards certain things, and certain stories have more import than others. I mean, the Omarosa stuff is a little tiring, but it's relevant. And even the story about the guy who oversaw the assassination of Osama bin Laden, it has relevance, particularly in the most important story, and that is, in my mind, what's happening with the Kavanaugh hearings. But in the meantime, let's talk about this. This is Omarosa has been releasing tapes. She has 200 tapes, supposedly. I mean, one can only imagine. And one of those tapes is a recording that Omarosa made of a phone call that she got from Lara Trump. Lara Trump is Eric Trump's wife, Eric Trump being the less stupid of the two Trump boys. And she was involved in the campaign, or she's involved maybe in the 2020 campaign. Now, there's been a lot of donations, apparently, to the 2020 campaign. And apparently what they do is they use that money as a slush fund to keep people quiet, as evidenced by this conversation with Lara Trump and Omarosa as seen on MSNBC or played on MSNBC. Here it is.
It sounds a little like, obviously, that there's something you've got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over as a campaign, like, we can't have, we gotta,
oh, God, no.
Everybody positive, right? And so the only thing that we have to consider when we're talking salary as far as the campaign is concerned is that, as you know, everything is public. And all the money that we raise and that pays salaries is directly from donors, small dollar donors for the most part. So I know you were making $179 at the White House, and I think we could work something out where we keep you right along those lines. Specifically, let me see, I haven't even added up the numbers, but we were talking about like $15K a month. Let's see what that adds up to. 12. Yeah, so that's $180,000. Does that sound like a fair deal for you?
There you have. She goes on to say, in terms of your position specifically, I really feel like your position would require, you know, you to be flexible in terms of where you are. Sometimes you'd come to New York for occasional meetings, but I would love if you could occasionally go do speaking engagements, that sort of thing. So in other words, this is a classic no-show job. 15 grand a year, I mean month, I should say. And apparently some donors are getting a little upset that their money is being spent on a no-show hush fund, slush fund job. And, you know, it just goes to show you, Omarosa, maybe she deserved to win The Apprentice. I think she came in second.
I think Omarosa is so impressive.
And the business acumen, she knows. If she can get
seriously
180 from Lara Trump, what's she going to get from a publisher when she starts to release these?
Boom.
I mean, if she was super smart, what she would do is she would have created her own podcast, released these on her podcast for Patreons only for the first 2 weeks, and then release it live.
I didn't want to say anything, Sam, but this is going to be my last day.
Yes. There you go.
I don't love that. Hey, what about Brendan releasing tapes? You should I say it? He's a low life.
He's a low life.
Low life.
Low life Brendan.
Low life Brendan. That's what we always call him.
Bark, bark Brendan. That's what I call him. He's a dog.
I pull Brendan aside. It's like there's some ethics questions about the inkjet fund.
One more clip to play before we get to Cliff. The best part is that despite the fact, and this is creating quite a stir, and the idea that she recorded, you know, we don't know. It could be the rest of the tapes she has after this Lara Bush thing, which they are spending, I guess, a lot of time trying to deal with, particularly in terms of donors. Donors seem to be upset about this. The last thing that you want your money that you donate to Donald Trump to go for is to pay a black woman. I mean, that is that is completely the reason why you donate to Donald Trump is so that money does not flow to black women in particular, I would think is the but nevertheless, here is Fox News trying to pretend like this is not a big deal. Meanwhile, every story coming out of the White House is they're in a full-on panic mode, like nothing they've ever been in, short of the president's campaign chairman almost being convicted of a crime at this very moment. So here is Fox News doing their best to bail out of a sinking ship.
Meanwhile, Omarosa, the former White House aide and reality TV star, revealing a new secret recording featuring the president's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump. Doug McElway is live at the White House. Doug, is there anything significant in this new Omarosa tape?
Dana, no bombshells, no release of any N-word tape, and that's highly significant because this entire uproar over Omarosa is predicated on the alleged existence of a tape in which the president uses the N-word. To date, no one has produced such a tape, nor any hard evidence that such a tape actually exists. Omarosa did provide this little bit of a teaser, though. Listen up.
There are things that I write about, and then there are things that I'm going to save to share when the time is right.
She's so good.
There it is, folks. Your next MSNBC contributor.
That's probably true. The cortisol, though, just going through Trump's body. How can you not love it?
She just, it's significant that they haven't dropped the N-word tape. We probably have 199 more tapes to go until we get there. Like, literally, it's possible. Every 2 or 3 days, she's going to release a tape. I mean, this is like the functional equivalent of that WikiLeaks dump. Yep. Where, like, every news story for 2 or 3 years was a function of a WikiLeaks dump. And it could just end up being this with the Omarosa tape. So good luck to you, Fox, by attempting to say this is not relevant. It seems to be the most relevant thing in the White House right now.
It is nice that they keep it in the family, though, you know? Do you think Trump thinks that you can't make someone testify against their father-in-law? Is that what's going on here?
Look, you got to keep them close. Definitely got to keep them close.
Keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family. Wow. Covet my daughter. What an arrogant word.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. We'll talk Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder. It is Casual Friday, folks, on the Majority Report. And you know what that means. It means that we gives us an opportunity to play this little ditty.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC.
Cliff Schachter, it has been too long. There's been a lot of travel in between here. I've been down to New Orleans for Netroots and to Pittsburgh for a teachers conference. I've been traveling all over, buddy. How are you? How was your summer?
I'm doing well. Been pretty good. Travel for us, too. Some work stuff, but a lot of stuff with the kids, which is always fun. Lake-type stuff. Swimming, frolicking, you know. Your basic summer stuff.
Nobody swims or frolics like you. And
I do my best.
And still keeping up with Unprecedented?
Yeah. Yes. That's been a lot of fun. It's still growing and we're still doing 2 a week and having some fun people on and having some good, interesting conversations. So come on by and join us.
There you go. Unprecedented, folks, on all of your popular podcast servers. All right, Cliff, let's get into this. There's a bunch of stuff I want to talk to you about, but let's start with something that is not going to get the attention that it should now, but I think it's going to have implications whether Elizabeth Warren runs for president or doesn't. I can see both scenarios being important. It's going to have big implications. Perhaps starting as early as, you know, February of 2019, Elizabeth Warren rolled out a plan that is entitled the Accountable Capitalism Act. That title is also interesting to me. I have a feeling that, but I know you've read into it, but, tell us what it is.
Well, overall, it's a number of things, but I think we get to the specifics. What I love about it is overall, it's taking, you know, it's going back to the notion under which corporations originally operated in this country. I mean, people don't, I mean, some people who study this and pay close attention realize, many don't, that, you know, from the mid part of the 20th century, the 1930s to the 70s, when we, you know, created the largest middle class in the history of the world in this country, and we had a well-regulated capitalist system that worked quite well, you know, this was the notion behind our businesses, which is essentially, you know, as a corporation, you owed the public, as we all do in a democracy, there's such a thing as a public good. You don't just exist to make money. You don't just exist to make your shareholders happy. You know, you have to be providing a public good or you can have your charter revoked. And the notion, what happened essentially, I mean, there's many things, we can't go into all of it, but coming in with Reaganism, we had the University of Chicago School of Economics, who sort of puffed out the notion of shareholder value being more important than anything else, as well as they snuck that word efficiency in there and tried to make the claim that monopolies would provide more efficiency. I think we've all seen what a pile of crap that is. We could have known that from what went on in the early 20th century and the reforms we needed to pass. So I love what this does, what Elizabeth Warren's plan does, because it gets back to the notion of what corporations are actually there for. And, you know, there's numerous factors behind it. One is realizing that much like states, as we know in our past, didn't do a very good job of protecting civil rights and women's rights when it comes to corporate charters. This is something where there needs to be more of a federal role. And so part of her plan is that a company that has over $1 billion in revenues will have to have a federal charter. Think about, you know, Delaware and some of the states that have become the go-to for charters because they're so friendly to shareholders. Additionally, in this, we're talking about there being a role for employees, for workers on the board, because so often board decisions are made, they're opaque and they're not in the interests of workers at a company, of consumers.
We're talking 40%, right? I mean, it would call for.
Yes.
All right. And so let's take each one of these points as we go. And you know, I think it would probably be worth us doing a whole show on that that concept
it really
of
would,
shareholder value theory that came in,
yep.
Like you say, in the early 80s via Milton Friedman into the Reagan administration. And I have talked ad nauseum about the work of Bill Lozonik on this program and two factors that really highlight, you know, that created a bunch of the wealth inequality and a lot of other really bad implications for communities.
I don't mean to cut you off, Sam, but everything here, right?
I mean, right. Like, yeah, I mean,
ignoring consumer interests, ignoring the environment, you know, ignoring corrupting politics.
How your labor, right. How your workers are doing, because it basically, yep. there were two major things that happened at that time, and that was lowering or creating basically a second class or a first class treatment of stock sales profits being taxed at a lower rate than work. So money being taxed at a lower rate than work in terms of what creates your income, and the idea that you could do stock buybacks. So all of this basically incentivized board of directors and C-suites to have a cottage industry within their corporation, where their pay was not a function of the company's long-term health, was not a function and all that includes, which is relationship with the community, with relationship with labor, relationship with consumers, investment in products, et cetera, et cetera. But rather the price of the stock, which, you know, goes up if profits go up because you've cut expenses by cutting workers. Now, that may hurt you 5 years down the road, but if you have the stock and you can turn around the next day and sell it because of this huge bump, whether it's, a buyback or other mechanism, you're going to make a lot more money. And it would be, you know, so right. We have these misaligned incentives.
Well, of course, go ahead. Right. Who among us? Well, I mean, if part of your compensation package is based upon stock options, which you can cash in at any time when the stock goes up to a certain price, how can anyone believe that there's not the most massive conflict of interest that could exist in human history? Like, I wonder what I'm going to spend all this money on. Am I going to pay workers more? Am I going to make sure to regulate and make sure we're not harming the environment? Or am I going to just do a huge stock buyback that is going to inflate the value and immediately up my compensation to some insane amount of money? And there's exceptions to that rule. There's people that actually have a conscience. But not most of these guys who get to that point aren't those people. And this is why regulations right. for capitalism to work need to be vibrant. The biggest thing I'll say quickly, you know, the work I've disclosed on this show that I've done in the past with Nick Hanauer, that was one of the biggest things that Nick has often emphasized, where I think he, you know, and Nick, just for everybody who does know who he is, was an early Amazon investor, knew Jeff Bezos from high school, and has come out and been a very forthright voice for progressive economic tax system. He's the one who fought originally for the $15 minimum wage in Seattle and that kind of thing. And his big thing for a while, and he's so right, is in 1982, pre-1982, buying back your own stock was considered stock manipulation. It was illegal.
It was illegal.
It was up there with insider trading. And then we decided, no, it's not. It's just a smart way of doing business. When really it's a massive conflict of interest for anybody on the board and anybody in the executive suite, because they're going to make a ton of money off of it. And so to me, Sam, this is so much bigger because as somebody, you know, whose background is in history, and you look at all the things that sort of the Tea Party groups and others forget, who just claim this sort of crazy sort of, you know, vision of individualism, like we're all Mad Max and we should all just be out for ourselves. They're forgetting the whole purpose behind democracy is that, you know, you're making some sacrifices for the public good. The public good is the most important notion behind democracy. It's the contract, the locking contract. And so corporations, that was a key part for them as well as all the rest of us, which is you don't get to just do it because it's good for you or good for shareholders. It has to actually serve the rest of us. By the investments we make in democracy and by the security that you're provided, and standardization so that contracts can be enforced and the rest, by getting that, this is what you're giving back. And just that cultural element that's been lost, you know, this kind of stuff could bring back. So again, this would make stock buybacks illegal again, what Elizabeth Warren is talking about. This would put, as you're saying, 40% of the directors, you know, would be from the workforce on a company's board, hugely needed for those voices to be there in the room. You're linking much more executive compensation. We've tried to do this somewhat in the past to say there's a limit on the amount of compensation, you know, an executive can make versus what the workers make. This is going to link that back, not just to the price of the stock, but to what the executive is actually making. They're required to hold onto their shares for 5 years.
Yep.
Not that short-term motivation to do a buyback or do some quick fix, churn and burn. So you make a big amount of money and you retire and leave everybody else holding the bag. I mean, again, this is the kind of notions, the kind of notion behind this was what was behind the New Deal, was what was behind originally regulated capitalism, and looked at it and said, how can this be made something so it is much more beneficial to all?
Well, and just to hit the point in terms of what it does in terms of inequality, but we also know, you know, on this program, and his name escapes me, we did a story about, I think it was from Ohio, about a glass, a town that made a glass factory. Would you remember with that story? Was it Ohio or Wisconsin? Ohio. And it was a perfect example of a town decimated because of these issues that we're talking about. And Warren, in the release of this legislation,
these towns grew up around these industries. Yep. That's why so much of the Midwest. I don't mean to jump in, but you know, like living in Ohio, that's why so much of the Midwest has been decimated. Because before that kind of notion we're getting to, that started with the late 70s and into the Reagan administration, the University of Chicago bunk, you know, these corporations actually felt that they owed something to their town. They didn't just pick up and leave because they were cheaper, you know, a cheaper way to exist somewhere else.
But let's
there
be clear.
Interaction.
But let's be clear here. It may be the case that a lot of these executives felt some responsibility to the community. But the bottom line is we had a statutory and regulatory framework in which that was what they had to do. And so, like,
no, yes, but that created a culture, I think, also where,
but I'm
you,
not
you know,
convinced
you were shamed if you didn't.
Right. But I'm not convinced that, like, look, you know, that it was cultural norms that were operating, or if it was regulation that created cultural norms, right? I mean,
no, that's
if,
what I'm saying.
Right.
I think regulations create the culture. That's why we need them, because I think they make it clear to people what our cultural norms should be.
Right.
And that's why we need these vibrant regulations. Like, you know, I remember going on your show a few years ago, Sam, and talking about our economic sort of, and this is, God, this will seem like the old days now. Remember Mitt Romney back in 2012? And I would compare him to his dad, who ran the big, you know, automotive company in Detroit.
Right.
And when he would refuse to take a salary above a certain level, he gave money back to the community because he felt embarrassed when he was making too much money, took pride in the product he was creating and what it did for the community around him. I'm not arguing that George Romney was a perfect man. I'm just saying you can see the evolution or devolution of capitalism from George Romney to then Mitt Romney, whose whole gig was going in as a parasite, taking over companies, destroying them, taking them apart, firing workers and taking all the money out of them. Like, just in that one family, you see this devolution,
right,
of, you know, so I agree with, you know, wholeheartedly that we need these. That's why I love this by Elizabeth Warren. These vibrant regulations are so necessary because they do create those norms and those expectations.
So she also noted that between 2007 and 2016, large companies, American companies, dedicated 93% of their earnings to shareholders. Now, we know that 80% of all stock is held by 10% of people in this country. So, I mean, you don't need to be a math genius to understand why wealth inequality has soared on the sort of, like,
and why the stock market is not an indication of how we're doing.
Exactly.
In this country.
And the flip side of that, which you can't see in the numbers so clearly, is when they make these decisions, they are naturally come at the expense of workers, of communities, of consumers,
sure,
and citizens,
in a new plant,
and,
right?
And people. Yeah,
right. Yeah.
I mean, all of it. And so, all right. So, and the reason why this is exciting in my mind is that someone is bound to pick up this legislation in the House. This is legislation that we're probably going to see. I mean, and, you know, I don't know if we have time to get into, you know, the fortunes of the Democrats in the fall. But assuming that they win the House,
if we get towards this, yeah, I mean, if they can take the House back, it can at the very least be introduced. And again, that's where culture is influenced. That's when the things we start talking about in the media, this is what in the past Democrats have been so bad at, is not understanding that if they don't make an argument, the media should play devil's advocate to some of the things that are said by Republicans, but they often don't. And if we're not making the argument back about what a stable, great economy that is growing and benefiting everybody looks like, nobody's making that argument. I mean, there are exceptions, right? There's some writers, Thomas Frank comes to mind, others who've done it. But overall, we need to be making these arguments And I love Elizabeth Warren for many reasons, but for bringing this forward, because I also think this is so comprehensive. It doesn't just talk about one aspect or the other. It's talking about stock buybacks. It's talking about, you know, federal charters for these larger companies, because states just can't do it, or it's much easier to buy people off in states, which was a lot of the original sort of impetus for the reforms of the progressive movement in the early 20th century and making those federal. I mean, it's taking some of the best elements from the progressive movement in the early 20th century, the New Deal, civil rights even, and you know, in terms of equality and worker representation, some of the reforms of the 60s, and looking at all this as a whole. And that's the way. One change here, just raising taxes on its own, doesn't do it. Although, I think we should do that, too, on the top 1% or more. But what I'm saying is, like, this, to me, is a whole new way of looking at our economy. And that's, to me, what's exciting about it, because it's necessary for us. And again, it's not like we don't have the proof, like, when we talk about other issues, right? When we talk about, you know, teen pregnancy, or we talk about guns, or we talk about the environment, we can often look to parts of Europe or other places that do these things well. And you can look to Northern Europe, and you can look to sort of some of the areas, which is why the right spends so much time trying to demonize Scandinavia, those places, because guess what? They haven't become Venezuela or the Soviet Union the way the right tries to demonize and pretend that those things are related. They've become much better regulated capitalist with some socialist element countries that have done this stuff well. I think it's Denmark. I was just reading something earlier. Was it? I think every 35 workers in a company is guaranteed to have one representative on a board for them.
In Germany, they do a lot of this with the board, too. And the whole thing is just, I mean, basically, you hear people talk about it as co-determinism, so that there is a there's some sense of that the value that workers are contributing to a corporation is recognized.
Right.
And that their participation in making the product is recognized beyond just.
I think where we've always.
Go ahead.
Yep. Sorry. I think we've always failed, on the left often is to not sort of, we do this sometimes, but to not make a clear delineation between smaller businesses and what big businesses can do when they get to a point where they control so much and where there's obvious monopolistic intent. And where they're so important to any one economy, it's almost that too big to fail. You know, so arguing that for entrepreneurship is one thing, and I have my own businesses and very much believe in that. At the same time, when companies get this big, we need the law and culture and everything else in place to make sure that they retain, loyalty, for lack of a better term, to the community they grew up in, to the consumers who are buying their products, to the workers who are working there, to all of us who breathe the air. And, you know, when these places get too big, they don't have to do that anymore. And so you can't just have that expectation, oh, I'm sure they will. It needs to be in the law. And so I can't, you know, I was reading this the other day, some of this, and then you sent this to me for the show and was following up on some more stuff. But, I mean, I feel like this is one of the best economic packages I've seen the Democrats, any Democrat, anybody offer in a while. And I'm excited. I mean, again, it's not going to go anywhere right now. The Democrats don't have a place to introduce it. But they take the House back. You know, again, I don't know whether we get to talking about some of the races, but there's some exciting things going on. There's a poll out there. There's a poll showing Beto O'Rourke slightly ahead in Texas. There's a poll showing Mike Espy slightly ahead in Mississippi. And there's demographics and turnout surges in those places that mean, are they likely to happen? I don't know. Could they happen? Yes. And so maybe we can hold on and even take a seat or two and take control of the Senate. And I think that, you know, things like this, if some of our candidates, including Beto O'Rourke and Mike Espy and others, would run on this, I think there's even more chance that they can win, you know, in those states. You know, let's be honest here. They don't need to win that large a share, particularly in Mississippi, of the white population to win.
Well, that's what's also so, that's what's going to be interesting to see, to the extent that this proposal is essentially weaponized in the context of some of these campaigns. I mean, everything I've been reading suggests that for the most part, what we're seeing, at least in the congressional races, is healthcare is a big issue. But it's going to be interesting to see if people pick up this mantle of being anti-corporate in some sense. And the more we can get candidates to sort of sign on to this bill before the election, it's going to be interesting to see who picks it up as a rallying cry. I suspect it's going to have implications maybe in the 2020 presidential races. We'll see. And
well, some of us, Sam, just as you know, are working on some 501c4s, for example, where we work on congressional races, and I'm in the one here in Southwest Ohio, and this is a good way of disclosing again as I talk about it, working on one that's trying to point out, you know, some of the terrible things that our representative here, Steve Chabot, is doing, who's in a vulnerable race, you know, that's a swing race. And the key thing about, again, is all the polling is the same on this. Healthcare, healthcare, healthcare. And now, granted, a secondary thing also is taxes, and those two are inextricably linked because the tax bill is what got rid of the individual mandate, which essentially sabotaged the ACA and has led to a lot of these spikes in premiums. But the Trump administration, of course, on September 10th, will be doing their lead arguments in court to try to eliminate pre-existing conditions as a requirement. And I'm telling you, I see all this polling a lot because of the work I'm doing. And, you know, this is it's cross-party, very much so. The vast majority of people realize now at this point that they could lose their health care. They could lose Medicaid if the wrong governor is elected or the Congress does something else. They could lose their coverage if they have a pre-existing condition. I have a pre-existing condition. It's kind of important to me, as many others, I think. And you'd be shocked, 130 million Americans have them. There are things, you know, like having been pregnant and having had diabetes. These economic issues are what will win because it's what people care about across the spectrum right now. And if people get out there and tell their stories about this, and that brings in this broader, you know, corporate charters, because corporations have hurt many people. And if they're busy dumping in your waterway where you are, so you're getting this, you know, this red tide garbage. And if they're, you know, they're busy firing workers left and right after promising that they would stay in their community and then, you know, hightailing it out. And, you know, and if consumers are getting hurt, this is the stuff that impacts people's lives every day. So this is what we need to be talking about. And I would throw in as a sort of, you know, a side note that's connected to that, as I said, the tax bill, you know, even what it did, because 83% of those benefits, guess who they went to? Not just the wealthiest 1%, but corporations again. So it is all linked to each other.
Let's talk about the biggest fight that's going to take place, I think, over the next 2 months. Mitch McConnell has scheduled
Omarosa's audio tape.
Well, I think that's going to be go on for a lot more than 2 months. Frankly, I get the sense.
Hope she has 200 of them just for the fun of it.
It's going to be sort of interesting. Yeah. See, she drops one of those every day into I do remember as a kid those calendars. I can't remember what they're called, but there's like a piece of chocolate every day until Christmas. What are those?
Yeah.
What are they called? Advent calendars. Yeah, this is sort of like that.
Oh, you're a little Christian there.
We got him for Hanukkah. All right, but let's talk about this. Mitch McConnell has scheduled the first day of the Kavanaugh hearings is going to be September 4th when everybody's just getting back from Labor Day vacation. And that week, to get it right under the radar. They have refused, the Senate Judiciary Committee, headed by Chuck Grassley, has refused to request of the National Archives to get documents related to Kavanaugh's time at the White House. But the National Archives staff has been going through these documents. In the meantime, a team of 50 lawyers, headed by a former lawyer who worked for Kavanaugh, is also going through these documents, looking for ones that are supposedly relevant and handing them to the committee so the committee can say that they got documents. But they're literally being filtered by Brett Kavanaugh's former employee. And
of course.
And so the Democrats have decided to sue if their Freedom of Information Act requests are not fulfilled. They are going to be suing out of their own with their own money or with campaign money, costing taxpayers nothing. They're being careful about this. That suit is ongoing, but apparently some documents that were released last night show that Kavanaugh, contrary to the way that he expressed it in both.
He lied, Sam. Come on, don't use New York Times speak.
Right.
Lied.
Oh, he lied in testimony, in written and in verbal testimony to the Senate when he was up for his appellate judiciary position as to the work he did on behalf of the Bush administration's nomination of Thomas Pickering, who was an avowed, well, I don't want to say avowed, but a racist judge. And Kavanaugh lied to the committee at that time.
Well, he also lied in emails that have come out about what he knew about the torture program.
Right.
He claimed that he wasn't told anything and nothing was shared with him. And in perhaps the most delicious aspect of that, did you see the email was shared publicly? Did you see who the email came from that sent to him that included all the talking points about torture?
It was...
You couldn't guess in 100 years, so I'm going to tell you. Harriet Myers is who sent it to him.
Oh.
How about that for a golden oldie?
Harriet Myers, remember just her? To remind people, was Bush's first nominee to the position that ultimately became Alito's, right? I think it was Alito.
Until they went through her record and they were like, she doesn't really know anything about the law. And so maybe she shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. Even Republicans rebelled against it. So I just find that to be
in retrospect, I wish they hadn't, frankly.
I know. I would have taken her over Alito. At this point, she couldn't be worse. But it's a good reminder, again, of the kind of qualifications that Republicans need to put people on the court, which are none. So Kavanaugh now has lied multiple times, and that's out there. You're right. Again, I mean, just on principle, the Democrats, the simple argument here should be, you know, first of all, he's anti-Roe. He's anti-precedent, so he's not getting on the court. Second of all, you guys stole a seat. And third of all, you're not sharing any relevant documents. I mean, did they actually demand like high school papers from Sonia Sotomayor and other people? I think they maybe had their art renderings from when they were in the third grade. But these guys won't share anything from Kavanaugh's time. As you said, they're going through and sharing just the safe stuff. But some other stuff has now gotten out there, and my guess is more will. You know, I mean, look, it's simple. And any of these folks knows they can pretend that they can do their whole dance of we need to talk to him, which they should, by the way. None of them should. But it's simple. Mitch McConnell stole a seat. That's it. That did not belong to him. That's part one. Part two, this guy will go against precedent. He has done it numerous times on the appeals court. And he has already made his ruling clear that a young immigrant, she was unallowed, in his opinion, to have an abortion. We know where he stands on choice. Among other issues, he also has made it clear how he feels on the Interstate Commerce Act in the ACA. He will overturn the ACA if he gets there. This lawsuit and what Trump wants. I mean, they can ask him all the questions. We already know his answers.
But
you know, and that maybe is why he's got the lowest approval rating of any of these judges who are sitting there, maybe being appointed since Bork.
Right. He's at 37%. But I got to disagree with you in this respect. All those things you said are true.
Okay.
All those things are said are true. That should be motivation for people who are listening to this conversation to get out and pressure their Democratic senators. Because the argument right now, like everything you're talking about, you know, or I should say everything you're talking about should motivate activists and regular people who want to keep Kavanaugh off the court. But in terms of the argument that Chuck Schumer should be making at this point, and I've said this, you know, a million times, but it just hasn't happened. Like this type of stuff that Kavanaugh lied, and even as ridiculous as this is, because personally, I feel like there should be a program where we limit security clearances after you leave. It should be one of those things like where, you know, like, you know, as soon as you hit 80, you got to go in every 6 months for an eye exam. You know, if you want a driver's license, there should be some function like that for security clearance. Everybody knows that this is a bastardization of that process to have Trump just, you know, like an authoritarian pull Brennan's clearances. I don't like Brennan, and it sickens me to read the following words. But it's, "Dear Mr. President, former CIA Director John Brennan, whose security clearance you revoked on Wednesday, is one of the finest public servants I've ever known. Few Americans have done more to protect this country than John. He's a man of unparalleled integrity, whose honesty and character has never been in question, except by those who don't know him." I mean, all that makes me want bile to rise up in my stomach and spew out of my nose. But that was written by William McRaven, who I also, are not terribly excited about, but he oversaw the assassination raid.
Bin Laden raid.
Yeah, that killed Bin Laden. But As much as all of that stuff makes me nauseous, this is exactly the letter that Chuck Schumer should be using to get folks like Doug Jones and Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp.
Donnelly, McCaskill, and Heitkamp.
Yes, all of them, including this stuff about Kavanaugh lying. That should be the only argument that we should be hearing right now, because it's the only one that's going to compel those Democrats. Oddly enough, the pro-choice stuff will resonate more with a couple of the Republican senators like Murkowski and Collins, but they need to get the Democrats in line. And the only way you do that is if people show up. And I got a clip here. I mean, I got a story here about, you know, folks harassing Doug Jones at an Alabama two or three days ago town hall. That needs to happen in West Virginia. That needs to happen in Indiana. That needs to happen in Montana and in North Dakota. And it's got to come out with stuff like, you cannot let the president nominate someone who has lied to the Senate, and you cannot let a president who is
who's under investigation
and doing this weird stuff with security clearances as sort of, you know,
well, so look, Sam, I
lowbrow as that
part.
Is that's what it's going to be.
The key arguments have to be, to me, what you just said, what Trump doesn't have the right to appoint somebody in the situation we're in right now.
But it can't be. It can't be
having committed.
Right. Right.
But in addition, it's exactly what you're saying about Kavanaugh lying. Where I disagree with you is I honestly think the third part of that argument is about choice, because I can tell you again, in plenty of polling I'm seeing, and frankly, just knowing the landscape, there are a lot in every state where there may be even a vulnerable Democrat. Pro-choice women are their base. You sell out pro-choice women at your own risk. If you're willing to put somebody on the court who will literally not just harm, as others have done, but eliminate women's rights in totality, then you should be ready to not have those women turn out to vote for you. And that includes Claire McCaskill, and that includes Joe Donnelly and the rest of them. So I do think that is still an essential part. Women having autonomy over their bodies, women having control of their destinies, is an important part of this. And there's even a hell of a lot of suburban Republican women who've been coming over to the Democratic Party on these issues too. So, you know, if you want to make a three-legged stool, maybe that's it. But I think it's the lying, it's the Trump, and it's choice.
That's where
I would take it.
I don't understand, like, where are the forces that whipped up? We saw this a year or two ago when they were trying to repeal Obamacare. We need this level of agitation for these senators in particular. When they go back to their home states, they need to be afraid. They need to be made afraid that they are. I mean, it just seems to me that the leverage for a guy like Joe Manchin is that you're going to put a liar who lied to the Senate on the Supreme Court, a guy who even the guy who captured Bin Laden, has told this president to revoke his security clearance. Well, you're going to vote for that guy's choice to be on the Supreme Court? What's wrong with you?
I mean, no, you're right. These need to be the conversation. I mean, 12
so annoying.
Former heads of the CIA and DNI put out, it wasn't even just those two, 12 former from both parties have now put out a letter on this. I think all these voices need to be brought. Now, that's what I fought for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, whether you like it, whether it nauseates you, whether it bothers you, this is how you win.
Exactly.
Because you bring in voices that add credibility to the argument that this guy can't be trusted and the guy he's appointed is appointing can't be trusted. And in the longer term, that's how we win.
Yeah, I mean, you can both say, like, you can articulate simultaneously, I have no faith in the intelligence community, but Joe Manchin does. Right. So you've got to leverage this stuff. I mean, this is
a strategy. It's what you think, any faith you, I, or anybody else has in any particular community doesn't matter with Joe Manchin's voting. It's who he has faith in.
Exactly.
And so put aside what you and I and anybody else believe. And part of winning in politics is you find out what moves the people you need to move. It may be something entirely different than anything any of us ever thought of, but what moves them is what you need to do.
Exactly right. And folks got to get out. And if you have an opportunity to call your senator, call your senator, But if you have the opportunity to go to a town hall in one of those states, whether it's, you know, with Joe Manchin or John Tester or McCaskill or Donnelly in Indiana or Doug Jones in Alabama, who am I forgetting? Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota.
Heitkamp.
I hope Matt right now, I know Matt's listening to the show. He's just rolled out of bed. And Matt, go visit Heidi Heitkamp's office right now. Stage sit-in. YouTube it, and we'll play it on the show. But, yep. I mean, this is what's got to happen to stop this guy, because they're going to try and
I mean, if it's not all hands on deck, we'll lose. Again, this is a Supreme Court seat. This is end game stuff. This is a 30, 40-year appointment. And this is for, again, this is somebody who has made his intentions clear to overturn everything we hold dear, and then we can elect the most progressive government of all time. And the Supreme Court, like they did during the Lochner era, like they did during the early, you know, Federalist era, can just sit there and just keep overturning stuff that, and saying it's unconstitutional stuff that we passed. It's legitimate. This guy doesn't, I mean, again, an issue dear to me. He's come out and taken the extreme Clarence Thomas, Scalia. Those are the only two, I believe, position that you can't even regulate assault weapons. So anybody gets it would be unconstitutional. So all those state bans and anything that we're going forward on, done. There's unfettered view of what their ridiculous ahistorical view of the Second Amendment is. But take the same thing with their view on global warming not existing, women having no rights to their bodies. We know how they feel about the Voting Rights Act and equality. And we think all this stuff's been bad the last 10 years. You know, get that all on steroids. Like, if you can fight one time, I mean, I would add obviously the presidential election and Congress, so maybe three times. But this is up there with those two. Like, this will have that kind of a long-term impact. So get out there. Do whatever you can.
Cliff, always a pleasure, buddy. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too, man. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for calling. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bye. Cliff Schechter, folks. Cliff Schechter. Get out there. This is it. It is go time for the Supreme Court. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ronald Reagan, who I think certainly members know who he is because they hear him in the fun half of the program. And maybe folks on YouTube catch the show live. No, not La Poupée, something different. That wasn't Matt listening to the show. It was you. I was going to respond. Like, Brendan is on Matt's computer right now. And I was like, Matt just sent me the name of that interview, Glass House, the 1%. And I was like, God, Matt is good for Matt. He's in. He's back at home in North Dakota, getting up early to watch the show. Jeez, that is great. I was gonna write back like, dude, what are you doing? That's funny.
I'm just trying to keep things as unchanged here as possible.
That's very sweet of you. And Ronald Reagan will be. We're gonna be talking to he. As you, some of you may or may not know, he is an immigration attorney, and he has some colleagues who are working on a, I'll let him tell it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ronald Reagan. Johnny Cool was king, he was the leader of the Boot Boys. He never caused no trouble in a rumble, make some noise. He heard about some chick and the way she liked to rock. He said, come here, honey, let me see you lift up your frock. Gonna be a little showdown. Miss Lucy was the chick and he knew she liked the ball. He said, come on, Lucy, don't matter to me at all. But Miss Lucy got a fella with a flick knife in his hand. Johnny
Johnny Cool pull a shotgun. The man's in command. Gonna be a little showdown. Showdown, yeah. Gonna be a little showdown. Showdown, yeah.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. Apparently, because is C-SPAN down right now? The national.
Thank you for calling Ronald Reagan's office. Ronald Reagan will be with you shortly.
Ladies and gentlemen.
So, anyways, I said to the guy, I was like, "Look, if you want me to keep coming to the gym, you either got to get bigger dumbbells." Or you got to get bigger plates. Those are your two options. Am I right? Totally. Let's go to the phones. You're calling from a 646 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
It's Sam Cedar calling for Ronald Reagan.
Sam Cedar. What's your mind? Gotta make it quick.
How long have you been like thinking about doing it this way? Like when I got on the phone, as soon as. Like, were you planning this out with your wife? Like, was your wife just like, oh, yeah, come on.
My wife came up with that bit.
She's just like, please, credit where credit's due. Can we just talk about something different, right? We have to talk about the show again.
I woke her up in the middle of the night, and I was like, what if I do this thing where, yeah, she was all about that.
All right, so Washington Journal would not take your call this morning. And so instead,
I think they're screening my calls, actually, because Sean Spicer was on the other day, and I swear to God, I called 45 times and I couldn't get through.
All right. Well, so I will send you a link to a way of spoofing your caller ID. That is what I used to do back in the days when it'll cost you a little bit of money, but I have a feeling it'll be well worth it for you. You will get a lot of value out of it. You'll be able to say that you're coming from really anywhere in the country.
Are we on the fun half? This is fun half quality.
This is fun half quality content. All right. Well, let's get to it then. All right, shall we? For those who don't know, you are a Yakima abogado or a lawyer from Yakima, Washington. And you specialize, or in fact are, an immigration lawyer. And as such, you are aware of, you have colleagues who are who run into all sorts of different issues. Tell us what you're trying, what the project is for today.
Yeah, so basically, I've got a client who is detained in the Northwest Detention Center. There was an article recently in the Seattle Times saying that the bonds in the Northwest Detention Center. This is a GO for-profit institution. The bonds in Tacoma are among the highest in the country. And so we had a bond hearing on Monday, and the judge set bond at $15,000. And this is above and beyond what this particular family is able to pay. And so I decided to try and crowdsource this particular bond, but also knowing that bond comes back to you as long as we win the case, which we're going to do, because I don't want to get too braggy about it, but we're going to win. And so what we're working on is a revolving immigration bond fund where people can donate, and this money will be available for people like my client who have really good cases, really compelling cases, but they can't afford these bonds. And so the money will be sort of revolving in that way. So right now I have a GoFundMe up.
All right, well, now hold on for one second. Before we get there, before we get to the details, I just want to go through this a little bit. What, and we will put a link at majorityreportradio.com, majority.fm, to the GoFundMe. But what, I mean, contextualize $15,000 worth of bond. Like, the idea, right, is that you don't want the guy to skip out of town or something like that, right? I mean, where does $15,000 fit in terms of this type of situation? Is that atypical? Is it Is it higher than normal? Is that something you would see for someone who's like committed a violent offense? Just contextualize that for us. And what is that bond supposed to do? Keep him from leaving his family? I mean, what? It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah. So in terms of whether or not it's normal, bond is very random. If you talk to immigration lawyers, even I had a colleague who recently had two back-to-back bond hearings. The first one was for an asylum seeker, no criminal history, no issues, and bond was denied. And then the next one was for a guy who had a pretty troubling past and issues. And the same judge back-to-back set bond at, I don't know, something like $10,000. 15 is a little bit high. I also had a colleague at the court next door with a different judge who that same day had bond set at $45,000. So it's all over the place. It's hard to predict, and they've gone up over time. So this first judge actually was my very first bond hearing when I started 7 years ago, and I asked for bond at $5,000 and got it, and I thought I should have asked for less. But it was in some ways, again, a case where there were more concerns. And so, yeah, the point of the money is to secure their cooperation with immigration and to make sure that they go to their courts and that if they're ordered removed, they ultimately leave the country. Now, the judges are technically supposed to take into consideration ability to pay. So if you, like in the case of my client, he's 21 years old. He worked on a dairy before he was detained. He was raised essentially since 7 years old in a single parent home in one of the poorest towns in the country. $15,000 is maybe close to what his mom makes in a year. And so the judges aren't really taking into consideration ability to pay. They're just sort of picking a number out of a hat. That's how that process goes. And unfortunately, what happens in the detained context is we've had people with really good removal defenses where we could, and we never guarantee anything. You never know what can happen, but really, really high chances of succeeding on the merits of their removal defense, who will forego that removal defense and just take a deportation order because the bond is too high. Their final hearing is not till 3 or 4 months down the road, and they can't stand to be locked up. And so, then what often happens is when you do get to the merits hearing, the final hearing, the judge can make a terrible decision, and you can tell them, look, we have a really good appeal. The appeal's going to take another 6 months. And even if we're successful on the appeal, the case will get kicked back here, and we'll have to, basically hope for the best before the immigration judge. And so a high bond is often, a real deterrent for people to seek the relief that they qualify for. And so it's a big problem. And that's why we're hoping to raise the money, not just for this client, but for other people down the road who have good forms of relief, but who don't want to be detained. I had a client recently who had just got done doing 2 years, I think, in a federal prison, and he couldn't stand to be locked up in Tacoma at the GEO detention center. He's like, I'd rather be in federal prison.
All right. And so,
yeah.
All right. Well, so the idea is that you create this bond fund, and then what happens is, it's used in the case of this first guy, Umberto. And then Umberto, when he shows up in court, at what point does that money go back to the fund? And the idea is that this fund keeps being reused, right? Is that it?
Right. So, one of the issues is that the immigration courts are very backlogged. And so, depending on the judge he gets, and right now things are really uncertain because they're trying to add new judges, but if he bonds out, his removal case might take 3 or 4 years. And so his bond will be returned either once we win his case and he becomes a permanent resident, or if he's ordered removed and he has a final order and he departs, then we would take confirmation of his departure to the local ICE field office and the refund would be issued. So that's also one of the issues with bond is if you have a criminal case and you get a DUI and they set bond at $1,000, and if you don't have $1,000, you can go to a bail bondsman usually and pay 10%, and the bail bondsman will cover the rest. But bail bondsmen don't work with immigration bonds usually unless you have a house or some sort of collateral. So when they say $15,000, sometimes families will come to us and say, okay, so we need $1,500, right? We need the 10%. And the answer is no, you need all of it in cash. And so the money would come back to the fund after proceedings end, either by granting relief or departing the country. So that's why we got to go out there and win the case, which I think we will in this particular case. So,
all right. Well, we will put a link to this. And so, I mean, so, all right. So I'm unclear. So once you win that case, so it could take though a while. So, the idea is to get this bond fund, you know, at least as big as what you need for Umberto's case. Right. But then theoretically bigger, right. So that it could work.
Right.
It could start a rolling type of situation.
Right. What we're going to continue to do after this case is fundraise and to raise awareness and try and get other donations. We're going to be reaching out to Michael Avenatti and other rich douchebags to see if they can, you know,
we should say you're not a fan of Michael Avenatti's.
Do we have a can I have a minute to talk about Michael Avenatti?
Sure. Sure. I know how much, how deep.
I know this is fun half material, but.
Let's, go ahead.
We're so desperate right now for heroes that, like, I think we really, I did too, cling on to people like Michael Avenatti, even like, what's this guy's name? Tom Arnold. All of a sudden, Tom Arnold is like a resistance hero.
Right.
One day, Michael Avenatti decides he's going to be an immigration lawyer, and he tweets out a picture of an ICE form with somebody's name and their alien number, so somebody who's seeking asylum. This is like highly confidential information, and so a bunch of my colleagues, you know, tweet at him and say, "Look, you know, you should probably take that down." He doesn't, and then he blocks a bunch of them, and people are reaching out to him saying, like, let us help you. Like, the immigration lawyer community is very friendly. People help each other all the time. You know, and we understand we're sort of in this together. And he goes about blocking all these people. And at the same time, he's raised over $150,000. Nobody knows what it's for. And the other day, he tweets out that he had this big negotiated win where he got his client deported, who's a child whose mother was in Guatemala. And people were, you know, people were really happy about this, but like the government, that's what the government wants to do. They don't need private lawyers to come in and say, like, help us, let us help you facilitate the expeditious removal of all these children, including children with viable asylum claims. And then of course he tweets out these pictures of himself, you know, in line at the airport with a kid, and he's got a picture of the kid. Again, it's like, you know, he has no regard for privacy issues or potential. I don't know. The guy is horrible. People need to stay away from that guy.
Yeah, let him do his job to the extent that it's helpful and annoying Donald Trump. But he's now in Iowa, my understanding, looking to do a presidential run. So let me be clear. It seems like you're not going to support him as for president in 2020. Is that right?
Right. Well, and it's just the whole thing is odd. And I, when he was getting involved, I thought, well, he's going to be suing ICE, or he's going to be civil litigating, which is his area of expertise, presumably. And instead, he's getting in there and getting his hands dirty, trying to get these kids deported. And it doesn't make any sense. Nobody knows what the money's for. That's kind of the big thing to me. it's just a weird situation. But I think I'd probably vote for Tom Arnold before I voted for Michael Avenatti. But
all right, well, at least we made some news today.
Yeah. So, yeah, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Good.
Well, yeah. We're going to point people to this GoFundMe. It is gofundme.com/bond-out-Umberto. People should go there, contribute some money, share it with your friends on Facebook, on Twitter, on, I don't know.
Yes, please do, everywhere. And I can't really stress this enough. I've had other clients in the past who, you know, struggled to afford bond. This is a situation where the particulars, the particular facts of this case really necessitate him getting out. There's issues with the custody of his child, and if he's deported without being able to get custody, he might not ever see his kid again. And there's other factors. He's just a really, really good kid who deserves a second chance and deserves the support of the community. And I really appreciate you for, you know, I reach out to you. I try not to plug myself or anything I'm involved with on your show because I know that money is a zero-sum game. And when you pay the bills and you got $100 left in your pocket, it can only go so many places, and you're a, you know, a listener-funded show, so I'm sensitive to that. But so I'm grateful for the opportunity to come on and promote this. I appreciate it.
And well, you might as well plug your podcast. I know you want to.
No, I'd rather not. Actually, people don't need to listen to that. It's just some nonsense. But I did follow John from San Antonio yesterday. And on Twitter, and I tweeted at him, and he hasn't responded. So it's a, you know, the early seeds of that bromance are, have been planted.
Well, I don't think, and, I don't get the sense
we'll
that, I don't get the sense that he is on Twitter that much.
Right. Right. Well,
give him,
you know,
time,
we'll see.
Man. You've got to cultivate him like an orchid.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jamie, where
hold
were you
on.
During
before
the,
you, before you,
the last interview?
Hold on for one sec. Before you redirect this, before you redirect this conversation, mm-hmm. right? Redirect.
Yeah.
From away right. from your talk of your podcast, I just want to say you're an immigration law and you have perspectives, right, Stephen?
Right. That's right.
Right.
I think that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're going to redirect that.
Jamie, so I sat through the first interview, and there was some talk of well-regulated capitalism, and you, I didn't hear you at all, and I thought you must be out of the office. Or what's going on? They lock you in the closet for that? Or
you know, as long as we have to live in capitalism, we all have to have a job. So I figured I'd best keep my mouth shut during that.
There you go.
All right. Well, I thought I would bring it
take
up
that,
and make things weird. So take, you're welcome.
Take that. Take that, Yakima Abogado. Thank you, Stephen Robbins. We will put a link to that GoFundMe. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Reagan.
Man, what chutzpah this guy has. It's always the former Mormons who have the most chutzpah.
Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, it's always unbelievable. Comes on.
He did some Krav Maga on you with that call.
No, jujitsu, not jiu-jitsu, Krav Maga.
Whatever, I don't know.
Not Krav Maga.
Oh, man. Got to pick my battles, folks.
Yeah. Well, you know.
I got thoughts, but I've figured out, as this show has gone on, when it's strategic to say them.
There you go. Revolution's not going to happen overnight. You got to have an interregnum period. And I happen to believe that the more space that is created for the less. I mean, I think that there is you know, there's the argument that you should follow accelerationist policies, that the heighten the contradiction, heighten the contradictions is the most effective thing. I happen to think that it is actually when you start to see a loosening and a you will get more opportunity for reforming and possibly, well, I don't know if we're going to see a revolution, but
well, you would to the extent that MSM Sam
to the extent that those things happen, it is when people have more time to and more ability to think about these things rather than have to worry about how they're going to make sure that their kid has health care or make sure that they have money to put food on the table, or they worry about losing their job. So that's yeah. That's my perspective.
I actually agree with you somewhat, Sam. Like, we saw this starting to happen in the 70s when the welfare state was still strong and organized labor was still strong. People were starting to revolt in much more radical ways. Unfortunately, it came right before a giant fiscal crisis that we have yet to fully recover from. But I would love to see Elizabeth Warren's policies become the mainstream of the Democratic Party so that the left has that to push against instead of what we are dealing with now, which is just terrible.
There you have it, folks. There you have it. All right. Well, you know what? Let's take a quick break, head into the fun half. We're going to take a phone call, 646-257-3920. We're going to do the IM machine. Folks, go to, we'll forego the, I said it earlier, but we'll forego it for now, the call to the majority report. But justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. All fair trade. Today, in lieu of making that decision to support this show, I mean, if you got the cash, obviously, do all of them. But give some money to that GoFundMe to get this idea of a at least bond for specifically for this guy Umberto. But to get this rolling bond fund would be a great thing. So this is hopefully just the beginning. Meantime, this week, of course, is Friday, which means that earlier in this week it was Tuesday, because that's the way the calendar works. And on that program Tuesday, what happened Tuesday night, Michael, at TMBS?
A lot of things happened.
You don't have to outline them specifically.
I'm going to do
more broadly.
A TikTok of each minute of the show. But I want to start at about the 35-minute mark where Brendan made a pretty funny joke, which led to an interstitial transition to the Gulag segment. No, there, you know, actually, the one segment I will mention was just recently clipped on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel, and it was with Trevor and I, T, from Champagne Sharks, and Matt entitled it, Ben Shapiro Falls Short of Recognizing That AOC Is Out of His League. And that was about a 40-minute segment, and included
so it was a short joke.
It was a lot more elaborate than that, including a new Ben Shapiro pickup artist character, which is a lot of fun. This Sunday, for patrons, we're going and did a deep dive on the roots of the war in Yemen, what's actually happening there, and also Saudi strategy in the Trump age. So patreon.com/TMBS, and you could check out clips on the new YouTube channel.
There you go.
Oh. And Secret Celebrity Tuesday, this coming Tuesday.
Wow.
Secret Celebrity Guest.
Somebody just donated $2,500 to Umberto's bond out fund.
I shouldn't have
Hell
done
yeah.
it, but it just felt right.
Wow, that's pretty good.
That's amazing. Where is it at now?
It is now at almost $3,500. All right, folks. Oh, and Jamie, Antifa. Antifada. What's happening with that? Are we going to go and talk about how Elizabeth Warren's legislation is not up to snuff? I'm joking. Go.
Oh, I mean, it's possible Sean will drop a hot single on the limits of social democracy and why it is not going to solve the problems of capitalism.
Sweet.
Given our current economic conditions. He's afraid it's going to be boring, but I think that people will like it. I'm encouraging him to do it. But This week on the Antifada, we had a comrade communicator of the Intergalactic Workers League talking about Posadism. We kind of go back and forth between our producer Andy and comrade communicator about whether or not the latter day writings of Jay Posadas, including the very influential essay Flying Saucers, The Process of Matter and Energy, Science, The Revolutionary and Working Class Struggle, and The Socialist Future of Mankind, 1968, whether or not this was the rantings of a burned out activist who forgot to do self-care, or a natural extension of Trotsky's catastrophism into the modern age. We also have a Real Posadas Hours coming out this weekend as a bonus for our patrons, where we discuss a never-published essay by Jay Posadas that's pretty interesting. And also, this weekend, we are having on Army resistor Spencer Rapone, who you may recall as the guy who wrote Communism Will Win on his cap at his West Point graduation.
Wow, there you go. All right, and don't forget, Literary Hangover is in effect. Matt's somewhere in North Dakota. Gosh knows what he's doing.
Bro.
All right, 646-257-3920 is the number, and we'll be turning on the IMs. Folks, if you're having problems with the app, update it today, particularly if it's the Android. It's impossible for us to test all of these elements of the app without you checking it out first. We do not have tens of thousands of dollars to spend on QC testing, before we roll it out. So bear with us. It's a free app. If you can find another podcast that has a free app that has the functions that ours does, I encourage you to use it and enjoy. But if you don't, you just bear with us and just go and try the latest version of it. All right. Quick break. Fun half.